From MainePublic.org, I'm Barbara Caridi, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Thursday, November 3rd, 2016. And on this day, Maine's Sugarloaf and Sunday River ski resorts are being sold as part of a deal that includes ski resorts around the country. Included in Maine's high number of absentee voters are prison inmates. Maine is one of only two states that allow prisoners to vote. And another pedestrian fatality shakes a Maine community. This time, it's a Lewiston Middle School student killed while walking to school. Those stories and more after this.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Master of Public Health Program, preparing students for today's complex population health and health services needs, and Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, presenting Gardens Aglow, where visitors will see the gardens in a whole new light. Tickets available at mainegardens.org.
I'm Barbara Caridi. The Sugarloaf and Sunday River ski resorts in Maine and four other New England ski resorts are being sold. And that's just part of an $830 million deal that includes ski resorts, theme parks, and other recreation properties around the country. Fred Bever reports.
Sugarloaf and Sunday River's land and infrastructure are owned by a massive real estate investment trust called CNL Lifestyle Properties. Now the properties are changing hands in a deal that involves two companies, Kansas City-based EPR Properties and a multi-billion dollar institutional asset management firm based in New York called OCZIF. OCZIF will be the nominal owner of the Maine properties, although EPR is providing financing as well. The deal is expected to close in 2017. Officials with the various companies involved in the complicated deal would not comment, but to Bob Luce, chairman of the select board in Sugarloaf's hometown of Carrabassett Valley, the handover looks like good news. He says in recent years it was apparent to the mountain community that the owners did not have much cash to invest in equipment and other needed upgrades. 2 years ago, Sugarloaf skiers were injured when its King Pine lift spun backwards. This summer, Sunday River's Spruce Peak lift collapsed.
They haven't had the capital, so I think that they've both been struggling with that. It'll be better in the future going forward or give them additional access to capital to do whatever expansions they may have in mind.
At Camden Snow Bowl, an unrelated ski area, General Manager Landon Fake says the acquisition of large ski areas in different regions of the country by a single owner has proven to be a valuable hedge when skiing conditions in the West prove to be less favorable than the East or vice versa.
I think that's a trend in the industry. I don't think it's going to mean any major changes for Sunday River or Sugarloaf. They haven't been owned locally for quite some time.
And while the deal involves real property at the resorts, their actual operations are administered by another company called Boyne Resorts. Boyne has long-term contracts to operate Sunday River, Sugarloaf, and another mountain that's part of the deal, Loon Mountain, in New Hampshire. It's a relationship that's benefited skiers in the region whose ski passes are good at all three. Luce and others say they are confident Boyne's operations will continue smoothly. There are a total of 14 ski resorts affected by the deal, in addition to the three mentioned. New Hampshire's Sunapee, Vermont's Okemo, and Massachusetts' Jiminy Peak are also changing hands. Western properties include Utah's Brighton and Colorado's Crested Butte resorts. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
And the election is only days away. And if absentee balloting is any indication, Mainers are voting this year in greater numbers than in the last presidential election in 2012. Mal Leary has more.
As of 5 o'clock last night, over 188,000 Mainers had already cast their votes through absentee ballots. That's a little more than the total number of absentees cast in 2012. Democrats make up the largest number, a little over 42% of the early voters, with both Republicans and unenrolled voters making up about 27% each. Voters have until the end of business today to request an absentee ballot. But even with the large turnout so far, Maine may not break the 2008 record, where nearly 237,000 Mainers cast absentee ballots. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
And among those in Maine voting by absentee ballot are prison inmates. No one keeps track of exactly how many prisoners vote, but Maine and Vermont are the only two states that allow them to do so. Other states restrict voting even after sentences are completed. But as Susan Sharon reports, some of those policies are starting to change.
Compared to other industrialized nations, the United States is one of the most restrictive about allowing those convicted of serious crimes to vote. According to Mark Maurer of the Washington, D.C.-based Sentencing Project, more than 6 million people are unable to vote in this election, either because they are behind bars or they have felony convictions. That's a number that has climbed sharply over the past four decades, and it's especially significant for minorities. Most states restore the right to vote after a sentence is completed. Some make former inmates reapply to vote, and some ban them for life.
There are four states, Florida, Iowa, Kentucky, and Virginia, that disenfranchise all offenders for life for a single felony conviction.
Maurer says that means someone could be a first-time offender for felony drug possession, get sentenced to a treatment program, successfully complete it, and still be prohibited from voting forever.
The only way you can get your rights restored is getting a pardon from the governor, and in most states that's a very unusual circumstance.
At the other end of the spectrum are Maine and Vermont. And at the Maine State Prison in Warren, the NAACP has been holding voter education and registration drives for the past 10 years. This year, about 400 inmates participated in several correctional facilities. One of them was Doug Burr, who's serving a 60-year sentence for murder. He says he's been following the presidential election pretty closely.
You know, I look at it like, okay, it could affect my family, could affect, you know, people I care about. So I show interest in it. I get involved. I read a lot. I watch the news. So I try to stay up as much as possible anyways.
Burr's not crazy about either presidential candidate, but in the end, he says he voted for Hillary Clinton.
Call it a little selfish, but I would assume that any type of prison reform would probably come from the Democrats at this point. You know, there's a lot of things at stake. I mean, you get the Supreme Court. You know, you got judges that are going to be appointed. This election is huge.
Rachel Talbot Ross of the NAACP's Portland chapter says prisoners seem more engaged about this election than usual.
The enthusiasm and the interest and the commitment to vote feels to us like unprecedented in the last 10 years. It really feels very high engagement around voting this year. We're good that we helped make that possible for, you know, like I said, about 400 inmates.
Mark Maurer of the Sentencing Project would like to see other states follow Maine and Vermont's lead. It is fundamental to democracy to be more inclusive, he says. And over the past 15 years, states have begun to reconsider their inmate voting policies. New Mexico, Maryland, and Delaware have done away with bans on ex-felon voting. And Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Maryland have extended voting rights to people on probation or parole. But Roger Clegg of the conservative think tank known as the Center for Equal Opportunity says there are consequences for committing serious crimes.
One of the consequences is that if you're not willing to follow the law yourself, then you can't claim a right to make the law for everyone else. And that's what you do when you vote. You're either making the law directly if you're voting on a ballot initiative, or you're making it indirectly by choosing lawmakers and law enforcers.
Clegg says he doesn't object to states restoring the right to vote, but in his mind, it should be done on a case-by-case basis, after someone convicted of a serious crime has been rehabilitated and can demonstrate that he or she has turned over a new leaf. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
And a Maine prison inmate is suing a health care provider for refusing to assess her as a transgender woman. 35-year-old Scott Gagnon is suing Correct Care Solutions, citing years of fighting with the company's employees to acknowledge her as transgender. Gagnon also goes by Missy. The federal lawsuit says Gagnon has been diagnosed with gender dysphoria and requested treatments such as a higher dosage of hormone therapy and hair removal, but the requests were denied. Gagnon's lawsuit seeks gender reassignment surgery and other treatments. Gagnon also requests that a mental health professional who specializes in gender dysphoria be provided to all individuals who identify as transgender. Gagnon was convicted of arson after a fire in 2000 that destroyed a Bangor lingerie shop. Correct Care Solutions didn't immediately respond to the Associated Press's request for comment. Coming up, Lewiston Middle School grieves the loss of a student who was killed today while walking to school. Officials at the University of Southern Maine are investigating graffiti found in student senate offices that appears to express anti-Muslim sentiment. The Latin phrase Deus vult, which means God wills it, was found on a desk and a wall. The phrase was a rallying cry for Christians during the Crusades and has more recently been adopted by alt-right political activists as an anti-Muslim insult. University spokesman Bob Stein says the incident is being investigated by campus security and a team from the Office of the Dean of Students.
It's kind of early in the investigation. There's still a lot of facts that need to come out, but we're taking it really seriously.
USM student body vice president Matt Raymond says the graffiti is an, quote, act of criminal intimidation. He believes it's a reaction to Muslim students asking for applications to student government to become senators. Meanwhile, in Lewiston, counselors were on hand today at Lewiston Middle School to help students and staff absorb the news that a student had died after being struck by a vehicle while he was walking to school. As Patty White reports, it's not clear yet whether charges will be filed against the driver.
13-year-old Jaden Cho Sargent was walking to school Thursday morning in Lewiston a little past 7 o'clock. As he walked in the crosswalk on Main Street, he was struck by a red pickup truck driven by 54-year-old Lori Young of South Paris. Lewiston Police Lieutenant Mark Cornelio says first responders found Cho Sargent dead at the scene.
Speaking with the driver of the vehicle, who's completely cooperating with us, she just says that she did not see the young man until he was right there in front of her truck, and she couldn't stop in time not to avoid hitting him.
Cornelio says the accident is still under investigation, and it's unclear whether charges will be filed. Police will try to determine the speed of the truck, as well as whether Young was distracted at the time by her cell phone.
Preliminary investigation shows that she wasn't, but, I mean, again, this is still an active investigation.
Meanwhile, members of the Lewiston community are absorbing news of the tragedy. Lewiston Middle School Principal Jake Langless says he called students to the auditorium Thursday morning to tell them about the accident.
And as I shared what I could with them, it was completely silent. And the students heard that message and then exited the auditorium. Again, it was nearly silent. 800 people in an auditorium, most of them being 12 and 13 years old, you don't typically see that. And to me, that was very humbling and spoke to me about the gravity that the situation had on them.
Langless says there's been an outpouring of support from the Lewiston community, and counselors will be on site at least through Monday to offer support. Langless described Cho Sargent as someone who always had a smile.
He was, just a young man who was doing the right things, who was coming to school every day, had friends, did his schoolwork, and again, always pleasant. And it's tough to know that in an instant that can all change.
Cho Sargent's death is the 13th pedestrian fatality in Maine this year. The number is keeping pace with last year, which set a record number for pedestrian fatalities. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
And down in Washington, federal officials say questions about pain management will be removed from hospital patient satisfaction surveys. Physicians and lawmakers, including Maine Senator Susan Collins, asked the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services to remove the questions because of concerns that they could encourage physicians to prescribe opioids. The move is seen as a small step that could help stem the opioid abuse crisis. The problem with the questions, says Jeff Austin of the Maine Hospital Association, is that unless patients reported that their pain was always well managed, hospitals were penalized.
And that's an absolutist approach and probably not the right approach for something that is a common and expected experience when you're healing, which is pain.
By asking that type of question, says Lisa Letourneau of Maine Quality Counts, it likely influenced prescribing habits in favor of opioids.
It really puts a lot of pressure on providers the way the current question is worded.
And that could have inadvertently helped fuel the current opioid abuse epidemic. That concern led Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins to organize a bipartisan group of 26 senators, including Angus King, to ask the Department of Health and Human Services in February to reconsider its questions about pain management in hospital satisfaction surveys. With the news that those questions will now be removed, Senator Collins says in a written statement she's, quote, pleased that HHS has taken action to eliminate this possible contributing factor, close quote, to the opioid abuse crisis. Officials at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services say they're developing alternative questions about pain management for future surveys. And in Vassalboro, a manufacturer of high-end custom hardwood windows and doors has been acquired by the country's second-largest window and door maker. Tim Downing is president of Duratherm. Downing says he was contacted early this year by Iowa-based Pella to see if he was interested in selling the business. He says the purchase is part of Pella's plan to get into the luxury window and door market in which Duratherm operates.
They shared with us that they knew that they didn't know the business, but wanted to acquire companies that were already well-established, had the name brand, good reputation, and similar culture fit.
Duratherm joins two other recent Pella acquisitions that will be marketed, each under their own brand names, as the Pella Crafted Luxury Collection. Downing will continue to head Duratherm. He says the company will stay in Vassalboro, and he expects no changes in employment, wages, or benefits as a result of the acquisition. And in Augusta, the state's drought task force says October rains have eased Maine's drought, but parts of the state are still parched.
The rain we got in the last few weeks has eased the situation. Of course, we really needed it, and any bit helps. But with that said, we still have a long way to go towards recovery.
That's Tom Redstone with the Maine Emergency Management Agency. Redstone says northern Maine is no longer in drought, while southern Maine has eased from severe drought to drought conditions. He says the drought was 3 years in the making, and it will take a while to end. One key factor, Redstone says, is how much rain and snow falls over the winter months. And to tell us what weather to expect over the coming days, here's meteorologist Paul Cousins.
As the storm races out through the Gulf of Maine, the rain will exit eastern sections this evening. Mountain snow showers developing, cloudy and breezy for the remainder of the state. Temperatures settle to near freezing in the St. John Valley to the low 40s far south. Low clouds will be the strong suit tomorrow, along with a brisk northwest wind. However, south of the mountains, Orono and Holton, the overcast will begin to peel away at midday. Temperatures will range from the upper 30s to low 50s north to south. Mountain flurries will persist Saturday, a few sprinkles in the county, considerable cloudiness for most, a bit of sun south of Portland, 38 to 51 north to south. Sunday, the chilliest day, but the brightest of the weekend. Showers and flurries will evaporate over the mountains in north, but remaining mostly cloudy, partly sunny for the remainder of Maine. Moderate northerly breezes, upper 30s to upper 40s north to south. Temperatures begin their recovery Monday, sunshine plentiful, brightest all over the coastal plain. Mid-40s to low 50s north to south. Temperatures will continue to moderate right through Wednesday. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins for Maine Public.
And that's the news on this day in Maine, Thursday, November 3rd, 2016. Robert Holt composed our theme music. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall, Susan Sharon, and Andrew Catalina, and to Fred Bever, A.J. Higgins, Patty White, Mal Leary, Ed Morin, and Nora Flaherty for their contributions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You can rate and comment in iTunes, or you can email us at tdim@mainepublic.org. I'm Barbara Caridi. For all of us here at Maine Public, thanks for listening.